The following Dharma talk was given by Danika Shoang Ankele Osho at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shoang Osho is a Dharma holder and priest in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered freely. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is a poem by Mahadeviyaka, a sage from ancient India, the south of India, who practiced in the Bhakti Hindu tradition. And, you know, in all of the sort of mystic spiritual traditions, there's common ground. So, this is her poem on awakening to the divine. I do not call it his sign. I do not call it becoming one with his sign. I do not call it union. I do not call it harmony with union. I do not say something happened. I do not say nothing happened. I will not name it you. I will not name it I. Now that the white jasmine lord is myself, what use for words at all? What use for words? Now that the white jasmine lord is myself, what use for words at all? Now that I see Buddha is no one but me, how could words ever reach it? Now that this body and mind have swallowed heaven and earth, and not a single thing stands apart, nothing can be spoken. I remember so many years ago, we were having a mando, Daito Roshi was leading it in the dining hall, and I can't remember the question, but I remember the answer, and it was Hojin Sensei, who at that time was a much younger monastic, and she said, I can only nod to myself, which you might recognize as a line that comes up sometimes in the commentary. Same thing. I remember at that time, and this is, you know, one of 100,000 reasons why the Sangha treasure is a Sangha treasure. I remember at that time hearing Hojin and seeing Daito's response and being like, oh, they both know something and see something that I don't understand. How enticing. So, although we can ultimately only nod to ourselves and words will never reach it, we do speak about it a lot, only in service to help point the way. Helping to try and point the way across that vast chasm of language and concept into our own direct experience, where we see for ourselves, oh, what is the chasm? I mean, we know it so well. It's all of those tendencies that we have to be apart from our experience, commenting on it endlessly to ourselves, analyzing, describing, blocking it, rejecting it. And so this is why we're practicing in Sesshin, essentially practicing unifying the mind, gathering the mind, bringing ourselves into contact with our original mind. Luminous and bright, complete, containing everything, nothing outside. I was thinking about that metaphor of the moon, the moonlight reflected in water, and how, you know, in the still surface of a pond, the moon is perfectly reflected in the water. But if a wind comes and the water is riffled, then that image of the moon breaks up into thousands of shards of light, glittering but fragmented. This is kind of, it's a metaphor to talk about the way that the disturbed mind, the active mind, the agitated mind can kick up this whole luminous experience and fragment it and create I, me, you, this, that, which is a wonderful creation on the one hand. I wouldn't want to live without it. And on the other hand, causes so much suffering. So how do we illuminate? How do we illuminate? So it is difficult to become familiar with the unified mind. There's so much conditioning, so much going against it. The groove is so deep. It is hard. It is hard. But we practice in this way for one reason, for living beings, ourselves, and all of them. Because if we want to be free from suffering, this is the way. And so, perhaps we already know from our practice that the more that we can recognize the nature of phenomena, the more that we can start to illuminate self and the nature of self, the more we can cease from harm, the more we can practice good, the more we can actualize good for others. And, you know, we can see for ourselves how the agitated mind shows up in the world. Look at yourself, look at the world, there it is. And also how a mind at peace shows up. Look at yourself. Look at the world. I was thinking about a experience of agitation and settling that I had just really, really recently. Kind of, for me personally, really brought this home. So, last month, during Sesshin, I was on Hermitage, and I was a little bit late to get up to the Hermitage on Monday. There was some meetings that I needed to be part of that Monday afternoon, and then I wasn't really prepared, so I had to kind of go up the hill and pack a bit frantically and then like try and haul myself up there before it got dark because there's no power up there. And so I was a little bit in an activated state, just like getting my shit together. And I got up to the Hermitage, okay, hauling my stuff, and I opened the door, and as I walked into the Hermitage, I saw this little mouse tail go, and I was like, oh, hello, you know. There's often mice in the Hermitage, not a big deal. And so I, you know, sat for a bit and then still in a little bit of a state, decided to go to bed early, got myself all arranged there, went to sleep, no problem. And then I don't know what time it was, but somewhere in the middle of the dark, I woke with a start to the unmistakable sensation of mouse teeth biting me. My hand, I sleep like this, you know, with one arm under the pillow, and I like basically like woke up and hit the ceiling, and I knew immediately. I've never been bit by a mouse before, but it was unmistakable. It was like little rodent teeth just, and I was completely like, wait, what is going on? And I like, you know, felt for the light and turned on the light, and sure enough, I had a drop of blood on my pinky. Yeah, I was like, what the hell? Mouse bite? So I like turn on the light. I'm like looking around. Sure enough, there is the mouse. It's like looking pretty freaked out too, and like kind of running back and forth across the Hermitage. It goes like, they can run on any surface. They're amazing. So it like runs up the wall and across the beam and over the thing. And I'm like shining the light, trying to like, I don't know what, just talk some sense into it, I guess. And it disappears, and I'm like, okay. Turn off the light, get myself back in bed. My heart's, you know, beating a little bit, and I try, and I'm fading off to sleep when I feel this nose and whiskers on my hand. I'm like, you are kidding me. You came back? So the lights go on, and I'm basically, like, angry now. I'm pissed. Like, what the hell? I'm talking to the mouse. Like, come on. This is not okay, this kind of conversation. And the mouse is totally, like, running all around the Hermitage. And I'm like, I am not going to be able to go back to sleep. I'm thinking of, like, many things. And one of them that looms large in my consciousness is a book that I read in high school in which a baby gets bit by a rat. It was, like, I think Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, about, like, you know, an expose of the meatpacking industry. And I'm like thinking about this baby being bit by the rat, and here I am being bit by this mouse, and who is this mouse anyway? So I'm totally agitated. I decide I cannot go back to sleep, and long story short, I end up coming down the hill and leaving a note for Sekou, like, can you please leave me some mouse traps? I have a situation, da 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 da. I did specify have a heart traps, but in my mind, I was like, that little sucker can die. Anyway, the traps came, I set the traps, the mouse got quiet, nothing more happened. A couple days later, I did catch it. By then, I was way chilled out. And I like walked it down across the river and let it go in the middle of the night. And now it's the last morning of my hermitage. I've had a week to collect myself. And it poured rain the night before, and it's early, it's still dark out. And I'm sitting right in the doorway of the hermitage with the door open and doing zazen as the kind of the very first glimmers of the new day begin to show, and I hear behind me the sounds of a mouse just sitting. And do you know what? I guess this is a different mouse. This little mouse scuttles up and comes right by my leg. I'm sitting, and it pokes its little head out and looks around. I kid you not! I was like, this is so cute. And then runs away, and then comes back again. It felt like an illustration from a children's book, you know? So, what transformed? External conditions? Inner conditions, my mind? Where does one pick up and the other leave off? Actually, this is a really big part of our study and practice of the way. What's inner? What's outer? I remember some years back, Shugen Roshi was using the phrase, what we call the world, which is from the sutras and other teachings, quite a bit. Like he would be like talking and giving a talk, and then he'd be like, da 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 da, and you know, what we call the world. And I was always like, wait, what do you mean what we call the world? The world. Like, why are you saying what we call the world as though it's not the world? Why? Why is it what we call the world? I've been studying the Lankavatara Sutra. I'm really pretty early on in taking this up. And this is a sutra which is quite a core text of the Zen tradition. And it's thought that that as Zen was sort of coalescing as its own unique school within China, Chan, that the Lankavatara Sutra was a central part of that teaching and sort of the body of study that was gathering around it. And it's said that Bodhidharma, when he transmitted the Dharma to Huayca, transmitted also a copy of the Lankavatara Sutra. It's like this is the book. And I also read that as Chan grew more sort of developed, and you had larger communities of monastics working with a single teacher, that the Lankavatara Sutra was difficult and challenging. And so the emphasis, the sort of scholastic emphasis, the sutra emphasis of the tradition shifted to the Diamond Sutra, which is also very challenging, but maybe not in quite the same way. But within the Lankavatara Sutra, a main thrust of its teaching is the Buddha teaching on how it is that things exist. How it is that things exist. And that all things are have no self-existence, right? We speak about things being empty. And that all phenomena are in fact what we're experiencing as the world, what we call the world, is a projection or many projections of our own mind. It's like that whole luminous moon reflected in the pond, fragmented. And we see all the fragments and we take them for the world. And so the Buddha is teaching on this and uses a few different metaphors that the oneness of mind and the appearance of phenomena are like the ocean and its waves, are like a mirror and its images, are like a mind and its objects. And there's this phrase that is used a few times to speak about how it is that this comes to be. And the Buddha says, as the wind of externality stirs the sea of the mind, its waves of consciousness never cease. The wind of externality. Buddha says, if they are able, meaning sentient beings, if they are able to see how projections flow from their own minds, they will have their foreheads anointed by Buddhas from countless lands. In other words, being able to see into this quality of mind to project is our point of entry into the realm of the Buddhas. Once the perceptions of their own mind are free from projections, so there are still perceptions, but they're free from projections, right? It's like when you hear the bird, and it's not the bird, and it's not your ideas about the bird, and it's not like, oh, I love that bird, but it just runs through you, just that sterling sound. Once the perceptions of their own mind are free from projections, they are able to dwell in the perfection of wisdom. So the winds of externality, they're blowing. How do we calm them? How do we calm them? I appreciated in his talk yesterday when Gokhan sort of emphasized that word allow. Allowing the winds of externality to calm. You can't make it happen. It's like that line in the faith mind, trying to achieve passivity through activity just stirs up more activity. Or I don't remember the exact line, but you know, maybe, and you get the gist, hopefully, if you don't know that line. We can't, if we're using effort to try and make things peaceful and calm, that very effort keeps that churn going. So it's like really such a deep practice, this allowing, and takes so much trust. Yeah. This is a, first, just a little shout out to the resident women in our women's affinity group, because the presentation on Mugai Nyodai, we've been slowly studying just really brief biographies of some of the women ancestors as part of our monthly gathering. And someone presented on Mugai Nyodai, and it reminded me of her story. So this is 13th century Japan. And she is one of the luminaries of our tradition. She was like the first woman Rinzai master, at least that's recorded. And she ran her own, she was the abbot or abbess of her own women's training monastery, which was extremely well regarded at the time. And there were like five sort of mountains of monasteries for men and five mountains of monasteries for women, and she ran one of them. So it's kind of, I like to imagine that time of this really robust practice of women teachers and women disciples waking each other up. So she worked in a nunnery as a servant, and then but was there because she was interested in the Dharma. And there's an account of her kind of entry into practice and her realization experience. And I wanted to just take this small portion of this longer account. So she's being tutored by an elder nun who recognizes that she's interested, that she's hungry for the Dharma, that she's actually there to practice and study the way. And this elder nun says to her, "If you really want to know your true nature, you must orient yourself towards the source of delusive thoughts and get to the bottom of it. When you hear a voice, do not focus on the thing that you are hearing, but instead return to the source of your own hearing. If you practice in this way with all things, you will definitely clarify your true nature." And Mugai Nyodai, who at that time was known as Chiyono then asked, "What is the mind that fathoms the source of things?" The nun answered, "The question you have just asked me, this is an instance of your thinking. Turn to the stage where that thought has not yet arisen. Encourage yourself fiercely, not mixing in even a trace of thought. This is what we call fathoming the source." Chiyono then said, "Does that mean that no matter what we do as we go about our daily life, we should not observe things, but rather turn toward the source of our perceptions and unceasingly try to fathom it?" The nun said, yes, this is called Zazen. To return to the source, when you hear a voice, do not focus on the thing that you are hearing, but instead return to the source of your own hearing. Return to the source, not as a concept. What is the source? When you hear a sound, how do you return to the source? What is the source? Where is it? Over in the garden? Up the hill? In some distant, faraway land? No. You are the source. Return to the source. Return to your own experience. Turn toward the source of our perceptions and unceasingly try to fathom them. Fathom it, fathom the source. So fathom, meaning to understand, not intellectually, not conceptually, directly. It suggests inquiry, right? It suggests like wanting to understand. So bringing up that wanting to understand as we return to our own direct experience very deeply, that wind of externality has to begin to calm. We're returning to the source so that wind of externality isn't so activated. We're not going out. We're coming in, looking, trying to fathom, what is the source? We have to be awake, totally in the present, really watching that very subtle tendency to revert to concept and just staying with what is. Why? For the sake of living beings. Releasing externality. I remember that when I was, I guess in high school, I would sometimes go for a run in Riverside Park. And one day I had this experience where, it was in New York City. And so I'd leave the apartment and then like head over to the park and then run my little path along the river. And this one day I felt like, God, I feel like I can't get outside. Like I was outside, but I felt like I couldn't get outside. It was one of these weird sort of trippy moments that we can sort of stumble across. And I was like, what is this feeling? It was so distinct. It was so uncomfortable. It was so like particular. This feeling of like still being inside. What is it that makes us experience something as external to us? How do we know that like this is outside? Look closely. What's happening? When you look and you see what we call the world out there, what's happening? So, we are practicing letting go, not pursuing all thought. Just not pursuing. There's another portion of this passage with Mugai Neodai and the elder nun that I didn't copy, but it's cool because she's like basically getting more Zazen instruction, and she says the young Mugai Neodai says like, so Somebody else told me how to sit, and the way I understood it was that I should be trying to get rid of my thoughts, but like it's impossible, I can't get rid of them, and it just makes me more and more agitated. And the elder nun is like, yeah, totally, no, you can't get rid of them. It just makes you more and more agitated. Just don't grasp. They'll come. Just don't pursue, just don't follow. And I was thinking about how those of us who did the retreat with Jinpu last weekend, or if you heard her talk on Sunday, she was talking about this phrase, let go, and sort of saying how she thought it was problematic and a bit misleading, and saying that, you know, it's not really so much about letting go as moving toward something else. And she sort of evoked this image of like you're on one side of a river, and or maybe a small stream, and you step across to the other side. And it's not that you let go of your leg that's on the other bank. It's that you move towards, you know, so that's sort of de facto let go of. And I was thinking about that and how that can be, I thought, oh, that's helpful. Because it's like when thought comes, we can realize I'm moving into the present. I felt like that was how I was taking that in. What am I moving toward? I'm moving toward now. So then I don't have to get all entangled in like, am I letting it go or not, da 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 da, which can sometimes be a vortex that I spin on. Instead, it's like, no, come into the present. Use your senses. Use your body. Here now. And then we have to practice being with whatever arises. So this gets really subtle, because we are so into subtly manipulating our experience. Like we can't even see the way that we're doing that a lot of the time. I heard one teacher describe it as constantly twiddling with the knobs of our experience, right? Like you're trying to get it to come in close, like that. So instead, to just be with our experience as it is, which is much easier said than done. And I think our karmic conditioning is really big here. And we all have to find our own way through. I was listening to a teacher who talked about how we may have actually learned in our childhood or in other aspects of our life that it's not safe to feel what we're feeling, right? And so we've taught ourselves to depart into the mind, into thought, into story. And so we're going to need to do some healing as part of our spiritual work, which is essentially healing, so that we can stay with our experience. And that healing may be something that happens in the course of our zazen, and it may be something that we are exploring other modes, right? Therapy. Different modalities of healing and therapy work. That can be really helpful. Because we've got to shift this aspect of our karma. And sitting by itself does address it. That is the practice. But you see for yourself if other kinds of practices might be beneficial. And then we're seeing also like what is underneath all those thoughts. This teacher called that shadow work, right? Seeing into the shadows of our karmic conditioning. It's really interesting, right? If I'm having a lot of critical thoughts about other people, I should look and see, like, what's going on here? What's going on here that I'm projecting all this criticism out? If I'm feeling a lot of irritation with other people, I should look to see, what's the origin? What's the source? So not rejecting our experience. I wanted to share this portion of practice instruction. This is from a 16th century Tibetan master. And this book is called Clarifying the Natural State. And at this point, the teaching has sort of taken the practitioner through a succession of deepening meditation instruction. And then there's this section on how we stray. I find it so helpful. So they're all so good, but this is the one that I wanted to focus on because it has to do with not rejecting, how important it is to not reject our experience, that whatever we're experiencing, to not be messing around with it, to have faith that it is being present right there completely with what is arising that is our doorway. So Dakpo Tashi Namgyal says, straying with regard to the remedy has two aspects. Instead of recognizing the training as the indivisible unity of discard and remedy, and that by knowing your natural face, the discard becomes its own remedy, the basic straying is to regard the emotion to be discarded and the training as separate, and so to use the training as a remedy against the emotion. Whenever a thought moves or when encountering a difficult situation, the temporary straying is to believe that one can only be composed in meditation after the difficulty has been overcome. That's that wind of externality, right? That we have an experience and we think, not this. I need my practice to come and get rid of this anxiety. And then I can see into my Buddha nature. Instead of right here, now, this very manifestation of anxiety is not separate. The emotion is our mind. It's our mind moving. So we can't really reject it without rejecting mind. So you can see if we're rejecting it and we're rejecting mind, then we're going to be going like this, which we do. Until you stop and be like, okay, this. Okay, I'm not going to discard. It is that saying yes to this experience now. And I think about how surrender, you know, and like in that poem by Mahadeviyaka, there is this sort of that, like, you know, devotional surrender. This is zazen, folks. Devotional surrender to what is. Stop fiddling with the knobs and trying to surrender to the state that you think should be there. That's the wind of externality churning again. So, not outside of us, but not just totally inside. That's always like, you know, a dangerous sort of default is like, okay, well, if the external doesn't exist, then are you all figments in my imagination? I hope that your answer to that is no. No. So not outside, not inside, not self, not other. How do things exist? This is what we're looking at. And you know, we're using this like in a tradition like Zen, right? We're using mind and concept and form to create a monastery and teachers and students and a lineage and teachings and sesshin. We're using it. So it's like so powerful. We're shaping and creating our experience. And this has been handed down as like skillful upaya, right? Light the altar. Take your seat. All the way, bowing, vowing. We have an ordination on Sunday, a creation, skillful means. Why? For living beings. I do not call it union. I do not call it harmony with union. I do not say something happened. I do not say nothing has happened. I will not name it you. I will not name it I. So how do we open to our experience just as it is? I remember Miyotai Sensei, when I was working on Mu, struggling, she said, try practicing Mu as though you might enjoy it. I was totally confounded by that. Can we actually be with our own experience with that kind of mind? Fresh, open, not trying to season it up, make it something better, allowing the texture to be just what it is, not rejecting anything. Trusting our luminosity. Here's two more strayings, and then we'll wrap it. Straying with regard to the path has two aspects. Instead of recognizing that the training is the indivisible unity of path and fruition, practice and enlightenment, and that this fruition is present as a natural possession, the basic straying is to believe that the path is the training, while the fruition will be attained at a later point. Although the meditator does possess the exact training, the temporary straying is to distrust it and seek it elsewhere, hoping for something superior to meditate on and adding something better. Don't we do that? Catch it. Recognize you're straying. All right. to sit into your experience, no matter what arises, with the possibility that you might enjoy it. What does that open for you? Saint Teresa of Avila wrote, "But these two words he spoke changed my life. Enjoy me." What a burden I thought I was to carry, a crucifix, as did he. Love once said to me, "I know a song. Would you like to hear it?" And laughter came back from every brick in the street and from every pore in the sky. After a night of prayer, he changed my life when he sang, "Enjoy me."
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.